Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. I'm Daniel Browning. Today, a conversation with the writer Lorraine McGee-Sipple, who's just released her memoir, Hey Mum, What's a Half Caste?, about her life's journey to recover her lost Aboriginal heritage. We often hear stories about the Stolen Generations, where thousands of lives were ripped apart under government policy. But what about those Aboriginal people whose heritage has been lost or denied? Lorraine McGee-Sipple might not consider that she was stolen, but her life was ripped apart all the same. That's because those whose Aboriginal heritage has been lost or denied have still had something stolen from them. In 1942, her Aboriginal mother, Hazel Wooding, was forced by her own father to give Lorraine up for adoption because of poverty and the shame of being an unwed mother. Hazel herself had been an inmate of the Parramatta Girls' Home, a notoriously brutal institution. As Lorraine McGee-Sipple says so eloquently in the book, when you separate a child from its parents or its family, you rip a hole in the fabric of their personal history. Stay with me here on Away for a conversation with the writer Lorraine McGee-Sipple. Lorraine McGee-Sipple, welcome to Away.
Thank you, Daniel.
And congratulations on the publication of your memoir, I guess. It's your life story. Hey Mum, What's a Half Caste? Tell me about the writing of this book, because it's been over a few years, hasn't it?
It's been over about 12 or more years. And I started to write initially in 91 when my sister died, and that was poetry. And then I had to leave UTS as a mature age student to write this in 94, 95 to start on it. And I had no idea how to write a book. So I took myself off to different seminars and got a lot of books out of the library on autobiography, Aboriginal autobiography. Wanted to read stories. And I just listened and went to Sydney, the New South Wales Writers' Centre, and listened and went off to things related to writing, and that's how it started.
And it was, I think it's won the David Unipin twice in manuscript form.
No, it was shortlisted twice. Yeah.
Apologies. Yeah. So shortlisted twice, that must have given you some kind of, you know, motivation to keep on with it.
Yes, it did. It was quite exciting. The second time I thought, oh, I didn't get it, but, you know, at least it's up there and the name's on the board. And I was really excited about that.
I mean, you obviously believe that your life story is a story that needs to be told.
Yes, well, I was compelled to write it, and I don't know whether I thought about it going this far and this wide, and I was totally overwhelmed by the response that I've had thus far. But I think there's so many issues there, Daniel, that speak to a lot of people. And it helps break down, I'd like to think that it helps break down a lot of, you know, fear and the questions of Aboriginality. And, you know, there's no certain look, that stereotype look that's been created for us. And the way I was treated was because, you know, I had Aboriginal heritage, and I didn't know that back in the 1940s and 50s, and being called names that I never understood. I was very confused as a 9-year-old, and then being called a little black girl in my teenage years by a friend's mother, and, you know, and other issues that came up when I was about to get married. You know, those issues define who I am, and the struggle I had to really do something about it to find A, my family, and then it was about 7 years before I journeyed down to my Yorta Yorta country. I didn't know how to be Kulin. I didn't think I had the right to claim something that wasn't rightfully mine because I'd never lived it.
But now you've moved past that. You absolutely acknowledge that you have a right to be Koori?
Of course, yeah.
It's quite a triumphant story, the way that this story unfolds about how you become an Aboriginal person. I mean, you may have the heritage, but there's a process of becoming as well, isn't there?
There is, yes. And to be accepted by your elders and to be locked in there and have them say, oh, she's a McGee. That name came from my great-grandfather, who was Aboriginal, but obviously there was some Irishness back there, and he used to call himself the Black Irishman. He was my grandmother's father. And so being called, being, you know, connected with and told that I was a McGee, I was a McGee by relatives down Yorta Yorta country, down Shepparton and Echuca. That was just a fabulous sense of belonging and a connection to country and both my Aboriginality.
Did you ever get to meet... Let's talk about the genealogy here, because I think it's crucial to this story. Tell us about your birth mother.
Yes, my birth mother, Hazel, she was forced into adopting me. She thought that she could keep me, but it wasn't to be. Her father said, no, we can't keep her. We've got no money. We've got dirt floors, 3 rooms. You just have to put her up for adoption. That, you know, ripped my mother apart because she had been an inmate at Parramatta Girls Home when she was 14 years of age. She was one of the dark ones in the family, and her Aboriginality was never addressed, and she was always in punch-ups on the way home from school, being called racist names. And she had difficulty bonding with her other children after me, and particularly my sisters.
I guess when that happens, I mean, it's a story that we do hear, but I guess, you know, your story is distinct in the fact that, you know, we talk about stolen generations and about, you know, children being forcibly removed. Even though there are all these other types of stolen generations, if you live in a circumstance or an environment where your right to have your children and to have them with you is not supported, then you can easily claim to be a member of the stolen generations. Where do you sit on that? Because we've got a whole group of people who are adopted, given up, surrendered, or whatever you like to call, but still part of the stolen generations in one way or another.
Yes, I always say that it was my grandfather, my white grandfather, who was responsible for this. I like to let people know because sometimes I feel like I'm once again claiming something that, for me, I can only speak for myself here. I had this view, this idea, this notion that I hadn't suffered because I hadn't been ripped from my mother's arms by the government. But at the same time, I was taken from my mother and ended up in a home for the first 6 weeks of my life. And that loss at such an early age impacted on me, and I don't think I ever recovered from losing my mother. And my lifelong mission was to find her and to find the circumstances, to learn the circumstances of how this happened, because I was told, you know, a lot of lies, and which sent me off on a completely different path, a different journey, looking for, you know, a different culture altogether.
Mm. There were a few secrets and lies around your childhood. Now, you your parents, your adoptive parents, Flo and Alan, they were working on a pastoral property up in the upper Hunter region of New South
That's
Wales.
That's it, yeah, yeah.
Little place called, is it Isis River?
Isis River, it's 25 miles from Scone. That's the nearest town.
And tell me about that, because it must have been, you know, as you're coming into knowledge, as you're coming into a self-awareness, as a child, you realise that you're not, you can't biologically be part of the family that you have been adopted into.
No, I was never told I was adopted. It wasn't until I was nine, I was obsessed with photo albums. And I couldn't understand why I had this brown skin. I looked sort of dark looking and I couldn't understand that. And I could run. And I guess looking at the photographs and then being called a half-caste by the kid in my class, because it was a small one-room, one-teacher school at Isis River. And being called that name and hissed that name in my ear just really threw me. And I'm really unsettled by that and confused. And I went home that day and asked my mother, reluctantly, it was very hard because it was my mum and I didn't talk a lot, and I just thought I'm not going back to school tomorrow, and she wanted to know why. That's when I asked her, "Hey, Mum, what's a half caste?" Hence the title of the book, because that's I think where my story opened.
And that little boy, Wally, the little boy who, as you say, hissed into your ear, "You half caste." You know, I guess this is the starting point for the book. It's also the starting point for your personal journey, because that's when you learn that you're different, and perhaps, you know, there's no avoiding that now, and that's the journey that you set off on. But, you know, if that hadn't happened, you know, what do you think? Would your life's outcome have been different? I mean, would your journey have been different?
I don't know. I'd like to think that once I reached a certain age, that I would have gone searching for my family, because I needed to know who I was. And, you know, a few years after that experience as a nine-year-old, I was rummaging through my mother's drawers to find something that belonged to me, a document that would tell me who I was. And that's what I did. And that name I remembered, even though I was sprung by my mother and had that piece of paper torn up. I hung on to that name so that I thought I could use it for future. But I was always concerned about being grateful to my adoptive parents for adopting me.
And a lot of adopted children experience that. I mean, it's heartbreaking when, you know that you need to discover your true identity, your biological, cultural heritage. It's such a fraught question for Aboriginal people who've been adopted into white families.
Yes, it was very difficult. I thought if I try harder and harder, maybe Mum will love me. And I felt ashamed of being adopted. I thought I wasn't good enough to be kept by my real parents, and the circumstances behind that, I thought I must have been a horrible baby for that to happen. And kids of 12 just do not understand that, and that it was a sense of rejection, and the shame that accompanied that was very difficult. But because by that stage I'd been sent away from home and I'd been living in Sydney for a year with relatives I couldn't stand, because I didn't get on with the next teacher that came to that little bush school, Isis River. And that made me feel even worse, being sent away. I thought I really have to behave here because I could be sent to a home.
And that wasn't just an imaginary fear, because your mother used to she sometimes used that threat, didn't she?
She did, yeah.
Now, I mean, these issues, when we pore over our own lives and we try and understand how complex our relationships with our parents are, what are you left with from your adoptive parents? I know that you were very fond of your adoptive father, Alan, and he was like a great friend to you. But, you know, there were lots of complexities in these relationships. Where do you sit with your adoptive mother, Flo?
I made allowances for her with her brain tumour, which manifested by violent headaches. You know, I just, for a while there when I was very young, you know, 11, 10, 11, 12, 13, I thought, oh, she just hates me. She's always got headaches, and she can be nice to other people and other kids, but with me, I get in her way, and if I tell her I love her, she just pushes me away and says, don't be silly. And that really hurt. But then, you know, having said that, when I was older and her brain tumour was diagnosed when I was 17, a year or two after that, I don't know whether she was on medication and whether, you know, I was less trouble to deal with, and we became friends for a little while, and that was a nice part of our relationship. But she didn't want anyone knowing I was adopted, so then I'm struggling with the identity of who I am and not even telling my best friend that I'm adopted. So that just added to my sense of shame and alienation. And that sense also of relationships and the difficulty I had with forming relationships. I didn't have any trouble attracting people. It was, they couldn't get close. Because I thought once they did, they'd reject me as well.
Now, let's just pause there for a moment. And I know you've brought some readings from the book that you'd like to share with us, if there's one that's close to hand, you might like to just give us a few words to set it up, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. This is in March 1968, which would turn out to be the worst night of my life and set me on a completely different track of what I'd hoped would be a completely different life as a young woman. So March 1968. The door of our 15th floor balcony was open, ready for the southerly when it arrived. The day had been hot and I'd not long arrived home from work. I was so happy I was ready to burst. But Dad looked like he didn't know whether to laugh or cry. He stood up and began pacing the floor. He said he had something important to tell me. His voice was quietly serious, but he was smiling. Sit down, Toots. My mother sat on the lounge, a headache manageable for the time being. She looked at Dad, then I looked at him too. What could be so important, and why did he have to tell me now? I had just told my parents the good news, that I was getting married, but Dad already knew. Jack had come by earlier, and they'd been up the street for a celebratory drink. Dad cleared his throat, giving no warning of what was to follow. Toots, he began, when we collected you from Scarborough Home at Bondi, the social worker said we had to tell you something before you got married. Toots, your mother was white, but your father was black. He was a Negro. The social worker said we'd be sorry for taking you and that you'd have to be checked out by a doctor before you had kids. She said you could have throwbacks and your husband might think you'd been playing around. I don't know if the shock was showing on my face, but I do remember that my mouth was suddenly dry and I seemed to be having trouble hearing. Negro? Throwbacks? They'd be sorry for taking me? You see, Toots, no one else wanted you, but Mum and I did. I slumped forward on the lounge like a wounded animal, unable to move. What's the matter, Lorraine? Mum asked. Lorraine, what's the matter? She kept asking the same question over and over again, like a record needle stuck in a groove, her voice rising with each word. Alan spoke like a man on a mission. You'll have to tell Jack, he said, sliding the phone across the table towards me. I knew that she was mine, so I gave her all the love that I had. And one day she'll take me home to meet her mom and her dad. Whoever left will be my bride. It'll always be right by my side. I felt so happy I almost cried. And then I kissed her.
Now, what should have been the happiest occasion in your life becomes the very opposite.
It did, yeah. I knew then that I couldn't go ahead and marry this man.
You were in love, that's why you were getting married?
Very much.
Why did you feel... I mean, I know I wasn't alive in 1968, but I can imagine how that must have felt. Did you feel that you had been... ripped apart or ripped open, and that you couldn't possibly have a relationship when your body's in pieces, when your soul's in pieces?
Yes, I felt that, you know, it there it is on the page, you know, like they'd be sorry for taking me, and that I wasn't wanted. And so I thought, well, Jack deserves someone better than me, and... I was concerned for any future children that we might have, albeit throwbacks, and how they would be treated. And I could live with my own pain, but I couldn't live with the pain of my future children. I mean, this was my thought back then, all those years ago, 41 years ago. I was so deeply wounded and traumatised by those words that night on the lounge that time stood still. And I knew that I couldn't have a relationship with anyone, but particularly the man I loved, because he deserved, I thought, someone better. And I knew... too, that I really needed to find my family, but I was petrified of that.
What happened after that then? I mean, I know this, your story, you know, it unfolds, you know, I guess as life stories do, slowly, and there are, you know, there are crevices and bumps and hills and things to be overcome in that, on that journey. Where do you, just maybe just tell us what happens after this realization, or this, you know, finally you get the truth, and the truth is, you know, it's a heavy burden sometimes.
Yes, the truth took, you know, 13 years to find, and I knew that I should find my family, but this sense of rejection held me back, and... I wondered what I might find, this Afro-American father, and I thought, a nameless Afro-American father at that, and I thought, well, I'll have to start with that adoption order you know, that had been torn up in front of me that day when I found it as a 12-year-old. I thought I'd better start with that name that's deep within my psyche. I'll start there. And 13 years later I did. But in that meantime, after 18 months of not being able to work things out with Jack and I've sending him off completely in a different direction, and then going nursing, it was getting to the stage where I thought, I have to find my family because I won't make it to my next birthday. So in 1980, I made that decision to pull it out and get in there and do something about it.
And stop the rot, essentially, you know.
I didn't like what I saw of myself.
Now, on this very, you know, this there's so much pain in your story. You contemplated suicide.
Yeah, I did on a couple of occasions. The worst one was in May 1969. And no one knew what was going on for me. I never had told my best friend. And by this time I'd told Jack to go off and meet someone else. I did it on the phone and hung up. I sat down one day and I thought, I had a bottle of Amitel tablets and I was supposed to take one 3 times a day and one at night, so I thought I'll start with 4 and see how that goes. And I'd taken the 4th one when I realised what I was doing and I thought, I need help and I need it now. So I rang Lifeline. And they wanted to come and see me, but I wouldn't give my address out. But they wanted my phone number, so I don't know whether they'd kept me on the line long enough for that, but I ended up giving my phone number and they made an appointment to see them the following day. I had to promise that I'd go and see them. And I did. I didn't stick at counselling very long because I thought I should be over this. And, early the following year I started nursing. It was easier to do that than to tap into my personal life. So I thought I could, you know, forget about it.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, so I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me.
John Lennon and his rendition of Stand By Me, a song requested by our guest, Lorraine McGee-Sipple. This is Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Now, you sent Jack away forever.
Yeah.
Did you ever see him again?
Yes, we saw each other on 2 occasions over the years. And that Paul was really strong and he wanted to see me again. And I him. But by this stage, after 5 years, he was married and had a baby. And I was about to meet my family, my biological family for the first time. Or I had actually just met my mother. And
just describe that experience of meeting Hazel, your mother, for the first time.
I'll read the reunion.
Please do.
It was still dark on that spring morning in 1981 when I rolled out of bed, too excited to sleep. I'd been awake for ages, just 5 hours to go before I met my mother. My body was as weary as if I had been on night duty for a week, but my mind was alert, although darting all over the place. What did you call a mother you had never met? How familiar could you pretend to be? Would she think me odd for not having children? I wanted her to be proud of me, not disappointed. I dressed carefully in a red paisley print two-piece skirt and blouse, like peasant top. I love wearing red. It made me feel good, and I sure wanted to feel good today. Vera, the patron of Adoption Triangle, had phoned and suggested I leave the car at home and catch the train from Central Station to Y.E., where she would be waiting for Alan and me. Always a stickler about time, my father was waiting in the driveway outside the block of flats where he lived, holding a bottle of champagne. He told me he'd rung for a taxi 10 minutes ago. He was wearing his favourite sports jacket and brand new sports shirt. It was pale green. We hugged and complimented each other. Just then the taxi pulled into the curb. Alan opened the back door for me. Central Station, please, driver. Country trains. Once our seat belts were fastened, Alan reached for my hand. Here, Toots, you better have this. It'll help you relaxed. It was half a Valium. I thought I was already relaxed, but I swallowed the tablet anyway. By the time the train arrived at Y.E. Station, nothing seemed real. It was as if I were in a trance or had had too much to drink, what with meditating and taking Valium. It was a battle to get out of my seat. Having no idea what Vera looked like didn't bother me. There were only a few people waiting on the platform. Vera had to be the one with the grey hair pulled back in an old-fashioned way. Alan and I were the only ones arriving together. "Here's the car," said Vera, guiding us to it. I decided we'd take the long way home around the lake. It's very relaxing. Takes about half an hour. I didn't tell her that if I were any more relaxed, I'd be asleep. And to this day I don't remember any lake. Only Vera and Alan getting out of the car and leaving me in the back seat. I was struggling to undo a seatbelt that wouldn't budge. I felt confused and abandoned. By the time I was free and standing outside the garage, I didn't know what to do next. There was no sign of Vera or Alan. I decided to follow the path, not sure whether what was hidden behind the nearby bushes was the front or the back of the house. I looked in the direction of the fence. A dark-looking woman was coming through the gate, smiling at me. I remember thinking that if she was looking for someone, she'd have to ask next door because I didn't live here. Feeling vaguely irritated, I wanted her to go away. I didn't want to be distracted. I was about to meet my mother. She kept smiling and getting closer. She was carrying a large bunch of brightly coloured flowers. They looked like stocks, larkspurs and something else. I turned my head thinking she might be smiling at someone behind me. But there was no one there except me. This woman kept smiling as if she knew who I was. And now she was within arm's reach. No, no, this wasn't my mother, was it? Her dark skin reminded me of Maori women I'd met in New Zealand. For 13 years I'd been thinking my mother was white, but then I remembered what Hazel had said on the phone a few nights ago. So many words and images flashed through my mind. My mouth tightened. That bloody social worker and her lies. Hazel and I fell into each other's arms and held on tight, too afraid to let go, to even speak.
I can't imagine how, what kind of an effect that would have But, you know, the first thing that flashes into your mind is the, you know, this belief that your mother was white, it was your father who was African-American, and here you are meeting Hazel, who's quite clearly an Aboriginal woman.
Yeah. It was devastating. I thought of that 13 wasted years.
Mm.
It really ripped me apart.
And those first few words, when they finally tumbled out, what was on your mind? What did you speak about with Hazel, your mother?
Well, when we walked inside, she was sitting next to me, and I kept tapping her on the arm to make sure that she was real. I couldn't believe that this was my mother. She had beautiful olive brown skin, and it was silky, and I watched as the tears glistened in her eyes, and I don't remember what I said, but she told me about my brothers and sisters and my grandparents who were looking forward to meeting me, and my grandmother who'd named me, and I had a sister called Lorraine who was 13 months younger. And she had photos for me. And it was... I couldn't stop looking at them. The reunion with my grandparents and extended family was held at Little Bay. Alan, Joan and myself arranged to go with Hazel and John in their car. On the way, I could feel the tension building. So too was my excitement. Hazel mentioned names of cousin who'd be coming. But much as I tried to remember, very little stayed in my head. It would be a while yet before I met my other siblings. It wasn't far from Redfern to Little Bay near La Perouse. Just a matter of minutes, really. Everyone was talking and laughing except for John, who probably couldn't have got a word in if he'd tried. He pulled into the curb, outside a small brick home that belonged to my cousin Shirley Ann and her family. I was reluctant to get out. Meeting one or two people was okay, but could I cope with a big mob all in one go? We were halfway down the concrete path when the screen door burst open, and there appeared Auntie Pat, grinning from ear to ear. She spread her arms wide for a hug. "Hello, darling, it's so good to see you again." Joan introduced herself. "Pleased to meet you," said Auntie Pat, still hugging me while reassuring Joan that she was most welcome to join us. Then she kissed Hazel and Alan. "Hello, cuz," said a gentle voice coming down the steps. It was our hostess, Shirley Ann, Auntie Pat's eldest daughter. Hazel had spoken of her with affection on the way over. I sensed they were close, closer than my own sisters. Shirley Ann had been a dancer with an Islander group a few years previously. I thought her beautiful, and still do. Everyone was laughing, polite, as we walked up the steps. "Now you go first." "No, after you, Toots," said Alan, nudging me in the back. Into a sea of faces we went, and not one name tag. I was centre staged, but I realised I didn't feel like running away. I smiled and nodded, acknowledging each introduction. I had to remind myself every so often that I was the eldest of 50 grandchildren and my mother the eldest of 12 children. I was trying to take it all in. We later found out there was another grandchild, making it 51. My grandfather came towards me. "Hello, love." I noted his shaky voice. "It was me that signed them papers. It's my fault that you were adopted." He hadn't spoken distinctly, but I thought I'd understood what he said. I wondered if he had his teeth in. Hesitating, not sure what to say by way of reply, the words just tumbled out. "Where's your choppers, Pop?" This caused much mirth. My grandfather had his teeth wrapped in a handkerchief in his trouser pocket. He struggled to pull them out, then opened his mouth and slid the dentures in. He smiled, explaining he'd taken them out to eat. "Do you always do that?" I asked, unable to keep a straight face. "Yes," he replied. I held out my arms. "Come here, Pop." His trembling body quietened and his anguish subsided. I held him until my grandmother came to my side and whispered in my ear, "My darling Gloria." I pulled away from Joe and looked at her. I saw my brownness reflected back at me. Fancy being lied to about something as precious and important as this. The words were out of my mouth as though someone else had spoken. "Aren't you beautiful?" I touched her shoulder and then her face. She was wearing a powder blue dress and a white cardigan. The colour blended well with her curly white hair. Those soft brown eyes brimmed with tears behind her glasses. "You're beautiful too, Gloria, darling." Yes, Gloria. I was Gloria. Overcome with emotion, I had to sit down. Hazel was sitting by herself at a table, her head bowed. I couldn't tell if she was coping with all this. She seemed so alone. But Joan had a great time that day. Every time I looked around the room, she was yarning to someone. Later she would share her impressions with me, filling in the gaps of my skidding emotions. Alan and Joe sat next to each other for much of the time. They were talking and laughing, but their eyes were on me. There was a cake with pink icing. "Hi, Lorraine," had been written in white letters. I remember seeing my name marked out in silver around the edges. It sparkled like glitter. Beaming with pride, Shirley Ann's 12-year-old son, Shane, stood beside his work of art. How could anyone cut through love like this? Later, Shirley Ann gave me her photo albums to look through. "Anything I wanted, I just had to ask," she said. I couldn't get over how she and Hazel looked so like me when I was young. I belonged in this album. People were talking all around me, but all I wanted to do was look at these pictures and imagine myself in this group, that group, or next to Nan and Pop, along with all the others. I can remember sitting there, thinking how my search had really begun when I had stared at photos of myself in my adoptive mother's photo album. Perhaps all along I'd known I didn't belong there. Writing my book and having it out there, having it picked up to be published and then having it launched, it validates me as a person. And I think, wow, you know, people want to read my story. They want to know and hear the journey. And I just feel that I'm standing taller. And I'm proud to acknowledge who I am, my Aboriginality, and my white side as well. I always include that. And that was a separate journey to find my biological father. That came very late. But back to my Aboriginal identity, I feel so privileged and proud to come from such a culture. You know, it's the oldest living culture in the world, and it doesn't get any better than that. And I'm proud of my family and ancestors for surviving, and I feel really lucky to have found my family. It's not like that for everybody, and my heart goes out to those that are lost, because I know what that feeling is like. And you can be lost to your family, lost to your identity and culture. And some people never go home to that identity. They're not, for whatever reasons. And some, you know, don't make it to meet their family. It's too late. And even though you can meet your family, it doesn't mean to say that it's going to be an ongoing relationship. And that can be hard to accept, and I had to accept that early on with my mother. I thought, well, I wasn't meant to have a mother, and I felt like her mother, and it took a little while to work out that she was too damaged from her own experience, and the shame of being in Parramatta Girls' Home stayed with her, I think, for the rest of her life. She used to call herself the black sheep in the family. I used to call myself the same. and I understood her pain, and I took it on board, because you have to. I had to work through the anger and bitterness that I had, and the pain, and you know, that lost 13 years that can never be recaptured. You have to accept these things, I feel. I speak personally here, I had to accept them, because, you know, my life might have panned out a lot different had I have not. And I'd been in an abyss before, and my writing has helped me to understand the many premature deaths I've had in my family, both my biological family and my adoptive family, a number of, you know, premature deaths and sudden deaths, and the death of my beloved sister Lorraine and my beloved brother Tommy, suicide. And I think I have a responsibility to tell my story, to get it out there. And if in some small way it can help anyone, I think it will be doing its job that it's meant to.
What kind of resolution? It's really hard to talk about those kind of, you know, there's kind of, there's so much finality in the word resolution, but at the end of your book, as you know, your life's journey is still ongoing, it's still continuing, but what kind of resolution have you come up with about the events in your life? I mean, you talk about acceptance.
Well, I think there are things that happened at that particular time in history where the white Australia policy was in, the assimilation policy, you know, the secrets and lies that destroyed so many of our lives, and that was all those lies that impacted. I don't know if there's any family, I don't know if I'm answering your question here, but it impacted on so many of our lives, and that's an intergenerational thing. And I don't think there's any Aboriginal family in Australia or Torres Strait Islander family that hasn't been affected by the white Australia policy, the assimilation policy, having kids taken away, and the lack of social justice and human rights. You know, it's an ongoing struggle, and I think I have a responsibility with my book and in speaking out and protesting in whatever form, in whatever way I can, if I see injustice, and it is ongoing with the intervention and the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act. I have to speak up where I can and where it's appropriate, and I think that's what I have to do, and I'd like to think that I will be speaking up and doing stuff and addressing issues, whatever those issues might be, in one way or another, and just correcting people with their stereotypes and misinformation. And not by ramming it down their throats, but because I'm not, don't look, fit a particular stereotype image that's been created for me, I can log into different places and hear, tap into conversations where people don't realise who I am. And that's pretty powerful position to be in.
Working on families and our survival.
Emma Donovan and her new song Naranga, about the stolen generations. And it was requested by our guest, the writer Lorraine McGeesipple. Her memoir, Hey Mum, What's a Half Caste, is published by Magabala Books. More details on our website, abc.net.au/rn/away, and that's AWAYE. For now, that's our program. Join me again for more Indigenous art and culture Saturday evening at 6, and again on Monday afternoon at 3. As always, I look forward to your company then. But for now, have a great week.
Strangers, streetwalkers, possums, philosophers, and a whole lot more. These are some of the unforgettable experiences that shaped your city nights. Now, Radio National will select the best audio and written contributions for broadcasts on 360 and The Night Air later this year. But of course, you can pick your own favourites. The full gallery of City Nights entries is at pool.org.au.